Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
There's no agreement. Feminists are highly contentious and disagreeing with each other all the time. And in fact, that's one of the main arguments that's going on is exactly what do we want? Mm-hmm. And people have very different visions. Some people want a world in which it doesn't make any difference what sex you are. Some people want to accentuate those differences, but to make them not a source of inequality.
The enterprise of thinking about nuclear war is one that I think pretty much everybody does for the same reason, which is that we wish to avoid it. That's what defense intellectuals are doing. They're trying to think about how to avoid nuclear war, which they think you can do by trying to plan for one. I'm thinking about it from a different perspective.
Feminism and public policy. Conversations with two visitors at the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings. First, Carol Cohn of Harvard University discusses gender and the language of nuclear strategy. Following that, Jane Flax of Howard University discusses gender and justice in the United States. Carol Cohn is a senior scholar at the Harvard University Medical School, where she conducts research at the Center for Psychological Studies in the Nuclear Age. Carol Cohn appears on Soundings courtesy of the Dora Ann Little Lecture Series at the Duke University Women's Studies Program. Carol Cohn, welcome to Soundings. I got to hand it to you. The title and the title itself is enough to stop us cold. What is it, Sex and Death in the Rational World of Defense Intellectuals?
That's it.
What in the world's going on there?
Well, it's an article about the ways in which defense intellectuals, virtually all men, who have created the language and ways of thinking that we have for talking about nuclear weapons and nuclear war, it's about the way they talk and about the way they think. And the sex and death refers to, first of all, sex refers to some of the metaphors that they use when they're talking about nuclear weapons. And death actually refers to the thing that they don't talk about, the thing that's absent from what they talk about.
The euphemistic side of things.
Exactly.
Well, not even a euphemism. If you say it's absent, then we're not substituting things for it. We're removing it altogether, right?
That's right. Occasionally, death is referred to. You do talk about the numbers of casualties or fatalities that come from a particular kind of attack, let's say. But most of the time, you certainly don't talk about it graphically or descriptively. Often you don't talk about it at all, and sometimes you refer to it completely euphemistically. For instance, if you're talking about a counterforce attack, which is to say an attack that's targeted against your opponent's weapons, weapon systems, ports, airports, their military structure, you refer to the human beings that die in that attack or that are maimed and suffer for the rest of their lives.
How do you do this?
You call it collateral damage.
Collateral damage. Well, Listen, let's step back from some of the specifics. Is our language inherently sexist so that when we talk about nuclear war, we can't kind of innocently, wide-eyed look at these metaphors and say, well, that's just the way the language works. Why is it that you find a sexist element at work here?
Well, I want to say, I want to ask you to not think about it as sexist, but to think about a language that is filled with gender. In other words, a language that we all have in which we see the world not only as divided into men and women, but we see certain sets of characteristics associated with each gender. You know, men are supposed to be, or it is masculine to be, rational, logical, objective, dispassionate. It is female or feminine to be subjective, emotional, idealistic rather than realistic, and so on.
I don't think anybody would dispute that, but my question is, why do they necessarily have to be competitive or hostile or militaristic?
Are we on the right track there?
Yeah, I don't think that these two sets of characteristics mm-hmm. actually should be competitive with each other or even are opposed to each other. I think that, you know, to be human and to think well, you have to be things on both of those lists. You have to be all of those things. You have to contain within you the ability to act, both act like a man and act like a woman.
So if we were androgynous, then we would be able to do away with nuclear war.
No. Let me back up a little bit. My point then about nuclear discourse is that it is a way of thinking that has grown up interwoven with gender discourse. That the ways that we think about nuclear weapons have been affected by the values that this culture puts on the supposed characteristics of men and women. I was talking to a physicist, a male physicist, who was telling me that he was in a room with other physicists planning counterforce attacks, modeling counterforce attacks, and trying to figure out if you looked at it this way, how many casualties would it be if you looked at it the other way. They changed their models once and they discovered that with this plan of attack, there would be only 30 million casualties instead of 36, excuse me, fatalities, only 30 million immediate fatalities instead of 36.
Not incredible optimism. Huh?
Incredible optimism, exactly. And people were sitting around nodding, saying, oh yeah, that's really good, only 30 million fatalities. And he said to me, and all of a sudden I heard what we were saying, and I blurted out, I said, only 30 million fatalities? I've just heard what we're saying. Only 30 million? This is terrible. How can we talk this way?
Well, on a scale of what to what were the polarities there?
Well, just 30 to 36. That was mm-hmm. the only difference. Mm-hmm. So he said, and it was terrible when I spoke. Silence fell upon the room. I felt like a woman. Now, what did he mean when he said that? He meant that for him,
the moral, the subjective, the soft,
emotional, uh-huh. the impulsive, right. all of those things. And everybody in the room was embarrassed, and they, you know, sort of were politely quiet for a moment and then ignored what he said and went on. In other words, because those qualities of being concerned about the body, of being, you know, sentimental, emotional, and so on, are coded in our culture as feminine and devalued, they weren't allowed into the room.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does it do to the people who are thinking about planning how to use or not use nuclear weapons if there are some things that just don't get allowed into the room?
Well, are you telling me after a fashion, vastly to oversimplify, Carol Kahn, that if we have women running the country, we're not going to have nuclear war?
Absolutely not. Not telling you that in the least.
I mean, it's one thing to talk about linguistics. It's another thing to talk about human nature.
Well, what I want to say to you is that if you go back to that room with the physicist, mm-hmm. if he was a woman, he couldn't have said those things either. In other words, what you can't do when you're thinking about nuclear war is to take the female position in the discourse. Mm. You cannot say things that a woman would say.
Well, if we don't take the male position, if we don't take the female position, what kind of language are you suggesting that we use to talk about nuclear war? Is there an alternative language that would have, more important, alternative consequences on our behavior, on our policy? Is that a fair question?
Sure. I have two different answers at different levels. I think it's, of course, it's hard to invent alternative languages. I do think that it would be helpful to speak about nuclear war in more concrete and descriptive ways rather than purely abstract and euphemistic ones. But beyond that, I think that we need to start over again and learn how to talk about war and nuclear war in ways that are not so restricted by this gender discourse. In other words, I think that we have to develop a way of talking about war where you can say things that are considered wimpish mm-hmm. or are considered female, mm-hmm. and where those things don't just lead you to be dismissed immediately, but where you can actually raise kinds of issues that are now kept out. So here are some examples. A general was talking about the comparative advantages of a protracted versus a spasm attack, or releasing 70 to 80% of our megatonnage in one orgasmic whomp.
Mm-hmm. Now, did he do this? I say this myself with a straight face. Did he say this straight-facedly?
Or
he was not trying to make a joke.
Absolutely not. Uh-huh. Absolutely not. Another strategist refers to doing that as a wargasm.
Uh-huh. A wargasm.
A wargasm, uh-huh. Yes.
Well, and so what? I mean, we watch pro football on the weekends, and we hear about defenses and penetrations and this and that, and everybody seems to take it without, you know, falling on the floor and ridiculing
these
people.
Well, let me just ask you something. If something is presented to you, if you're thinking about something as being one orgasmic womp, mm-hmm. how does that make you feel about it compared to if something is presented to you as devastating the face of the earth?
Well, there is obviously a difference between
some
these.
Difference,
so
probably.
what we're doing is not only hiding behind euphemism and linguistic camouflage, but we've made it sexy in order to make it tolerable.
Exactly. And I think one of the very important things about the appearance of these sexual metaphors and other kinds of metaphors, like domestic and religious metaphors in nuclear talk, is that it makes it tolerable, and also, like any metaphor, it just channels your mind. It takes it from one set of associations and moves it over to another set, which in this case are quite pleasurable.
Well, it moves it from the destroyer to the creator.
Yes, that's exactly what it does.
After a fashion.
Which is extraordinarily peculiar when you think about it, because there could be nothing that is more the essence of destruction than nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And yet, a lot of the metaphors are about sex and about creation.
Mm-hmm. So what do you propose? Again, let me put this to you as a question. What do you propose as an alternative, Carol Kahn? How should we talk about nuclear war?
I want to change your question and say that we have to start someplace else. Mm-hmm. That what we need to do is to start thinking about how we want to talk about security. Because the reason we talk about nuclear weapons and nuclear war is because we've decided that they are one way to ensure our security, or at least that's what's implicit. And in fact, if you look in this society at, quote, security discourse, a lot of it is nuclear discourse. Mm-hmm. I would like to start at the beginning and to ask, what does security mean and what do we need to do to ensure it? And to talk about that fully, to talk about that not just from the perspective of weapons technology or military needs, but to really ask, what does security mean and what does it take to do it besides the military? What does it take to create security?
Well, we need what? You're lowering the temperature after a fashion. You're saying that we don't need to talk apocalyptically, finally, in military terms. We can talk about what is between us and, you know, the final explosion itself. Am I on the right track?
Yeah, why are we concerned about nuclear war? We're concerned mm-hmm. about nuclear war
because the other guy can blow us up.
Because the other guy can blow us up. That's a technological fact. Mm-hmm. But there are also political facts implicit there, like the other guy might want to blow us up.
Uh-huh.
Right? So let's start thinking about what is it that we can do to make it less likely that the other guy is going to want to blow us up. Things like the sexual metaphors don't actually make anybody feel like they want to have a nuclear war, mm-hmm. but I think it makes the planning and the thinking about nuclear war sort of more fun to do. And not only does it make it more fun to do, which I think it actually does, but also it keeps you thinking about certain aspects of war, or not even of war, while ignoring others. And my claim is that if you're going to think well about something, you've got to face it as directly as possible and as complexly as possible. And I think that these metaphors prevent that.
So if we end the enterprise of war, our language may be a little bit poorer, but we're going to live a little longer.
It's a nice way to think about it.
Carol Kahn is a senior scholar at the Harvard University Medical School, where she conducts research at the Center for Psychological Studies in the Nuclear Age. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Feminism and Public Policy continues. My guest now is Jane Flax of Howard University. Our topic is Gender and American Social Justice. Jane Flax is the author of Thinking in Fragments, Psychoanalysis, Feminism, and Postmodernism, published by the University of California Press in 1989. Jane Flax appears on Soundings courtesy of the Wilhelmina D. Harland Lecture Series at the Duke University Women's Studies Program. Here is Jane Flax.
Well, the main thing that feminists are saying these days is that we need to pay attention to gender. That gender is a relationship of power, in which women result with a lot less power than men.
Well, what's the difference between gender and sex? Do you make a differentiation?
Typically, feminists have made a differentiation by talking about sex as being the anatomical differences. Hmm. And they talk about sex as constructing males and females. But it's society that makes men and women.
Are we talking about the old problem of socialization, how we get to be men and how we get to be women? Are we all born the same sex? Is that what you're telling me?
I don't know if we're all born the same sex, but we're talking only partly about socialization.
Uh-huh.
We're also talking about something that becomes part of the very fabric of who we are, mm-hmm. so that it goes much deeper than just who does the dishes or who wears pink and blue.
I know that one argument that I could pose to you as a feminist is to say, hey, this is the natural order of things.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way, you know, if we're talking in a Christian framework or a religious framework, this is the way God ordained the world should be. Isn't this a little arrogant of you to try to rearrange the whole natural order of things?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Well, actually, I think it's pretty arrogant to say what we think the natural order of things is.
To make that assumption. All right.
I mean, it seems to me that we as humans create these stories about what is natural.
Uh-huh.
There's no little trumpet up there saying, this is nature, while telling you the way things are now.
Uh-huh.
So we make up stories and we say what we're familiar with is what's natural.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason to believe that that's so. And in fact, even though there have been these kind of gender relations for a long time, they're enormously varied. They're not the same. For example, in West Africa, women do most of the farming and the hard physical labor.
Uh-huh.
And yet in Western Europe, we say, oh, women can't be equal because they can't do the hard physical labor.
So we're talking not so much about sexual or gender differences as we're talking about cultural differences.
There are cultural differences in the way people experience gender.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one way that it happens. But one thing that does seem to go across cultures is an inequality in power.
Let's talk about the law and justice and feminism in the 1990s in the United States. Is there a feminist agenda? You said earlier that it's not monolithic. How do we figure out the goals, the ambitions, the ends, and the means?
There isn't a feminist agenda. And one of the disadvantages that feminism suffers under is that our media tries to make everything in their little 20-second sound bites.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so that they want to find a feminist agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And they create things which are really not at all what the common grassroots experience of feminism is. It's a very complicated and differentiated movement.
Tease out a couple of threads then for me.
Okay.
If we're not talking about a feminism, but many feminisms, is there one that, in your opinion, deserves what, the greatest attention, the most attention on the part of the public? Help me to figure that out.
Well, I think there's certain issues that deserve attention. One of them has to do with the growing poverty rate among women and children, that's very important. Another one has to do with health and reproductive issues, which I think are also really important. And a third has to do with the fact that women don't have very much access to power.
Mm-hmm.
And those, they're different sort of ways of working out these problems, but I think that these are three main things on the feminist agenda.
Which do you think is the most pressing, or does that create a smokescreen to say that one of them is more important than another?
I think they're so interrelated that we have to work on all of them.
Uh-huh.
You can't really separate them.
How are you going to bring these things along? What do you do, after all, to get these things in front of the public and to draw the proper attention?
Well, I think we have drawn a lot of attention. I mean, I think that it's ironic that a lot of the American political agenda in the last few years has actually been driven by a reaction to feminism.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the anti-abortion activity, a lot of the recurrence of the so-called traditional family values, a lot of Ronald Reagan's rhetoric, you can read as a kind of, unfortunately, anti-feminist
mm-hmm.
response.
And you're saying that it essentially was not, although it's been read that way?
No, it is.
Uh-huh.
But it's not. But what I'm saying is that I think that feminism has really shaken up people in a way that, of course, they don't want to really give full credit, but react against.
Uh-huh.
And that it's a profound kind of revolution because it's a revolution that gets us in our most intimate lives. It's not the state out there.
Yeah. Is it a revolution that's going on mainly in the academy and therefore the public really isn't aware of it?
No, I think the public is highly aware of it. They have to suddenly deal with women in workplaces as bosses. They mm-hmm. have to deal with change demands that their wives are making on them and their marriages.
Mm-hmm.
They worry about how their daughters are going to grow up. Little girls now expect to have jobs and support themselves, except mm-hmm. for black women. That never happened before.
Were you born a feminist, Jane Flax, or were you made into a feminist?
I was definitely made into a feminist.
Uh-huh. Can you tell me about that?
I was made into a feminist when I went to Yale University.
Uh-huh.
It's his greatest contribution to my life, probably.
Without naming names or throwing brickbats, what happened?
I went into an environment in which there were no women professors, mm-hmm. where the Department of Political Science used to meet at a place called Morey's, which did not admit women, where I was considered to be anomalous, where women were just coming into the university for the first time as undergraduates, where there were no gynecologists on the staff of the health center, and where women were really non-beings.
Mm-hmm. Has that situation changed?
To a tiny extent, I forget, I think there's maybe, 10 more tenured women than there were when uh-huh. I went to Yale.
Is this emblematic? Are women still getting the short shrift in American education?
Oh, absolutely. For example, in my...
Is it that bad?
In my field, which is political science, mm-hmm. only 5% of people with tenure are women.
Mm-hmm. So, why can we blame this on the quality of their scholarship, or is this a male conspiracy?
Well, the studies show that women do at least as much scholarship as men, but they earn, on the average, about $5,000 less a year than male professors with equal qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
And they are given tenure much less, and they're also hired much less by the prestigious research universities.
How's this situation going to change? Simply by virtue of the fact that women will move into positions where they can make the decision and monolithically look and say, I'm a woman, therefore I'm going to give preference? Isn't that unfair?
Well, I think that's not exactly what will happen. I do think it's a question of power. And uh-huh. of course, people don't give up their privileges easily.
Yep.
It's much nicer when you only have to compete with half the human race instead of the whole human race. so that there is a certain amount of power and discomfort which goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And it does make a difference to have women in more positions of power because they at least look around the room and say, hey, there's something weird here. There's no women.
All right. What are women going to do with this power? Is it really your sense that the world will change? Are we talking, after all, about gender or human nature?
I don't think the world will change just because women are in positions of power. My ideal of a leader is not Margaret Thatcher, for example.
Uh-huh.
I think that it would make some difference if people with different kinds of feminist perspectives were in positions of power, but already so much would have had to change for those people to be in positions of power
mm-hmm.
as well.
Does feminism necessarily involve a sort of radicalism? Does it necessarily involve establishment bashing? How does the change occur?
I don't think it's radical necessarily in our old sense of radical.
The 60s, Woodstock,
the 60s,
all that.
Or, something like that. I think it's more radical than we can even imagine.
Mm-hmm.
It's radical in the way that what's going on in Eastern Europe is radical, that it profoundly disorganizes our traditional ways of life.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't even begin to imagine what will come out the other end, even any more than I can imagine what Poland is going to be like in 10 years.
Where is the leadership coming from? Here's an instance where I will ask you to name names.
Mm-hmm.
Who have you got in mind?
But that's interesting, you see, because I think why it's hard for us to understand feminism is that we have a model of a leader. We have a model of a hierarchical, top-down, a male, macho, power-wielding guy.
Uh-huh.
And that's not the way feminism operates. Feminism is hundreds and hundreds and thousands of women running battered women's shelters, working to keep abortion legal, suing people to get equal wages or to change mm-hmm. the wage structure of their job. There isn't a leader.
So it's not important that we have a female vice president? It's not important that we have a female attorney general? Those are just emblems?
It's not important unless they have a feminist consciousness. It will make no difference to stick a biological female in a pre-existing power structure unless the power structure changes.
Well, speaking of the changes that you are proposing, Jane Flax, let me ask you to conclude our conversation. Talk to me for a few minutes about this new book that you have. It's called Thinking Fragments. One of the things that you are proposing here is what you call a conversational mode of philosophy. What, we all relax and we talk feminism?
That would be great. I wouldn't mind that.
What do you have in mind?
What I have in mind is that there's a change in the way that intellectuals need to understand themselves, that we don't speak truth. We're not the ultimate authority on matters.
Oh, boy, are you going to take some...
Really?
Pardon the expression, but flax in the academy on that.
Really? But that our job is to help make possible ways of people with very different ways of understanding the world to communicate with each other.
Be specific.
For example, what I do in my book is take feminist theory, psychoanalysis, and postmodernism, which are thought of as totally different, and most postmodernists don't read feminists, most feminists don't read psychoanalysis, and get them talking to each other and to show weaknesses in each other by, if you raise certain feminist questions, psychoanalysis looks weak. If you raise certain psychoanalytic questions, feminism looks weak. And so they can engage in mutually critical but also constructive conversations.
So it's okay for us to be aware of our weaknesses and talk to one another about them.
Sure. I mean, that's part of giving up the idea of what I have to do is give you a polished little truth package that you can't possibly criticize. It's boring, it's static, and it's not possible.
So the flawed may be the way to improvement, after
Absolutely.
All.
Absolutely. That's what we want to know about. Where don't things fit? Where things don't make sense?
All right.
Jane Flax teaches at Howard University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Feminism and Public Policy is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 513. That's program number 513. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, Richard Peterson of Vanderbilt University discusses country music, authenticity, and commercialization. Richard Hart of the Institute for the North American West discusses the culture of the Zuni Indians. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Happy birthday to the first building constructed by the United States government. It was the Mint, whose cornerstone was put in place during late July, 1792. 2 years before that, an early American industrialist named Samuel Hopkins received the first patent issued by the government. The U.S. Customs Service began its collections in late July, 1789. Kennedy International Airport is 42 years old this week. In early August 1939, the scientist Albert Einstein wrote to President Franklin D. Roosevelt. His letter marks the beginning of atomic weaponry. Jimmy Hoffa, the American labor leader, disappeared 15 years ago this week. Late July and early August birthdays include the Italian fascist leader Benito Mussolini, the American novelists Herman Melville and Booth Tarkington, the industrialist Henry Ford, the author of America's national anthem, Francis Scott Key, and the designer of the nation's capital city, the Revolutionary War officer, Pierre-Charles L'Enfant. Finally, this week marks an anniversary for the beginning of Christopher Columbus's journey to the New World. The year was 1492. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. Gender, Bombs, and Justice. Conversations with two visitors at the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings. Carol Kahn of Harvard University Medical School discusses language, gender, and nuclear strategy. Jane Flax of Howard University discusses gender and social justice in the United States. Gender, Bombs, and Justice. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings.